Hi, I'm Josh, and, you know, when my Mr. Fibes rises again, if he stays up for more than 4 hours, I consult an Egyptologist.
And a Volnavia, if they're available.
Exactly. She kissed him right in the Volnavia.
It's just like, all I can picture is George, Groucho Marx be like, I ain't testing that one.
Yeah, you just said the secret void. Please don't say it again, or the censors would cancel us.
That's the thing. That's the, oh god, just Vincent Price saying Volnavia 53 times. It's just, oh my god, it's just incredible.
Through his neck.
I know. He never move his lips on camera once. This is Charlie Dan Austin. You know, it's one of those things where, like, you know, I don't know why the Z. I don't really get it. You know, it has all of these good people in it, all these talented people, and it's refreshing and interesting in so many different ways. But maybe Kim Basinger just really wanted to be Blizz the Child, and that's why they have it, the title. It's just, I think that's why it didn't do well at the box office, is what I'm guessing. Oh, wait, no. I was talking about Slaughterhouse Rules. See, I'm trying to do my best Matt impersonation, being confused about what we were watching. And that was what I was doing there. And so also the Charlie Dan Austin, and that concludes our scene.
And, you know, Matt, once again, sadly, is unable to be with us, but we hope he will rejoin us soon and bless that child, you know? Just bless it. Bless the sweet little heart.
I have a lovely little mini rant when we get to Bless the Child about the culture surrounding Kim Basinger when we get to that one.
All right. We're going to talk about culture and Kim Basinger, and it's not going to have anything to do with wanting to cover her in yogurt, because this is Harsho Hot Dog. First off, we have a short film from David F. Sandberg, the beloved director of Lights Out, and Shazam now. So, right on, David F. Sandberg. So this is Cam Closer, and you can't say it without the accent.
You have to. It's part of the rules.
It's like that movie Haunter. What are you watching? Haunter. We are going out haunting. Cam Closer. So this is a very simple, like, proto Lights Out, I think, before Lights Out came to be. Just Lotta Loston looking through her phone, seeing different things through the phone than she's seeing in reality. This is like a cool twist in that it's the phone can't see her. And then when she looks around, she sees her body on the floor in the corner, and then it gets dragged off. So that's super neat. And it ends in your basic boogly. And, you know, but it's, again, with these, like, it's so hard to be mad at them because they're 2.5 minutes and Lotta Loston is so goddamn charming and the editing is so sharp. It's like, yeah, you know, this is a story that you've told a couple of times, but it's fine. You know, I don't think you have to rush out and watch it, but I ain't mad at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of just, it's the one thing that I will give them an epic amount of credit for is that their movies make me uncomfortable instantaneously. Like, I think it's just sort of like because of the pedigree of Lights Out, but like it's one of those things where you just kind of, you know, knowing going in to what you're getting into, as it were, it's sort of one of those things where it's like, it just kind of, I'm just immediately uneasy, like almost instantaneously with any of their things.
Right.
And it's just like, I'm just always on edge, like, instantaneously. I was like, don't do that. Don't do that. Why are you doing that? Like, stop doing that. It's like, you know, and also like looking through the viewfinder, is that the word? Screen. The screen of her phone and having it be different than what she's looking at. Like, that's just, that gets close to mirrors doing different things. And then, you know, but the boogly at the end kind of bums me out a little bit. It's like, man.
I could kind of tell that that's like leading up to the like epic Lights Out face because they had the white eyes. But then they had like they went for the scream. And then later, I think he figured out if you don't go for the scream and you go for the, it's better.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think this is a good, like, halfway to Lights Out kind of deal. Like I said, ain't mad at it. It's not essential. Sorry.
Yeah, I think they're so skilled at like assembly and editing where you just kind of go like, just let stuff sit. You know, just let it sit and stew. Because, I mean, you're so skilled at putting this stuff together. Like, just do that.
Oh, yeah.
Don't need to think of the end and go, bah! Like, just shut up.
And I love so few people have gotten that. And the ones that have, they really nail it. Is at the end, instead, you get, like, a very quiet thing sliding up behind them. And you cut before they get them. And that's it. Like, that is the stuff. It just makes you go,
yeah. I was trying to explain that. Actually, I was trying to explain this to Conlon recently, where we were bopping around on YouTube looking at various stuff. And then one of the suggested things was that English one, the short, The Blue Door. And it's like, and how goddamn great that is. And it's like, and I was just like, that one popped up, the whole thing, like, you know, suggested videos. And I was just like, I went, ugh. And Conlon's like, what? And it's like, oh, we did that one for the festival. And that one's... that was real good. And he's like, well, what makes it good? And it's like, oh, because they just don't want you to be comfortable at all. And it's just sort of like, and they don't do it with loud noises and big whatever. They vice grip you and they just get you. And it's like, I really admire that. I don't think it's very easy. I think it's very hard.
Oh, no.
I think it's very hard to do it right, you know?
We've seen so many where the attempt is to build tension. And if you don't build the tension, then all you have is nothing happening. And so it has to be the nothing happening in the, like, freakiest possible way. You know, it's like, it's the difference between the killer walking across the background and the score going nuts, and the killer walking across the background and nothing. And you just see him go. Character doesn't see it, but you saw it. And they didn't try to freak you out with a cat scare that you saw it. It's just, oh, and now he's out there and we don't know where he is.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's like the thing, like, if you're a fan of, if you, Joshua, or anybody listening, is a fan of the fantastic podcast Lore, Chris, the guy who does that, has this, like, really amazing way of speaking that no other human speaks like the way he speaks. Like, I don't know how he learned how to talk. It was like a combination of, like, watching Sir John Gielgud and also Speak and Say. And it's really amazing the way the man speaks. But he'll tell these stories, and some of them have nothing to do with the ghostly things or whatever. But some of them are kind of creepy and uneasy and stuff. But what's amazing is, like, he will do the thing where he'll kind of ratchet up his voice a little bit. But then this thing happened, and then this thing. But what I want to tell you about is this thing, and the other thing that happened. And then there was this thing, and this was kind of creepy. But, like, and maybe by design, but he does this thing where he'll go meandering past a super creepy thing. Just to can continue to tell you, like, about the next thing and what the story is, and you're like, you fucker! Now I'm completely uneasy. Like, it's just sort of like, yeah. You just meandered by this super creepy fact and whatever story it is, and it's just like, that wasn't the payoff. And it's like, I think this is on purpose. I think you're doing this on purpose to be sneaky. Like, you're not making the big voice, you're not making the big noises or the sound effects, like, nothing. You're just sort of meandering past the creepy thing. Like, oh, you suck. It's just like, I've been on the bus in broad daylight. Just had the willies wiggle right out of me. It's just like, God.
So I'll tell you something that was not particularly subtle, but had its charms.
Yes, it does.
Was the Slaughterhouse Rules, or Los Leyes del Matadero.
Yes.
It was good to watch this week while I was also watching Good Omens.
Oh, yes.
And... coming in between those two things and listening to David Tennant's interview with Michael Sheen on his podcast, I've suddenly become a giant fan of Michael Sheen. He is so fascinating a dude in that interview. And then to me, Good Omens is basically him and Tennant's show. Like, Michael McKean is hilarious in there. There's, you know, there's other shit going on, but those two are just the heart and soul of that. Their whole relationship and kind of romance. And then seeing him in this, where he has very little to do, but he is very funny. So yeah, I'm a super into Michael Sheen now.
Yeah, who knew? And it's one of those things too, where, like, Good Omens is definitely in my top 20, if not top 10 favorite books of all time. You know, I very dearly love it. And, like, I just think they did a wonderful job with the show. I really think they capture so much of what makes it good, you know, and what makes it special, and it's just, you know, they made some interesting decisions at different points, but, like, I think the whole thing works so goddamn well, and it does come back down to those actors. I mean, like, if you have somebody in there who you can't really grow to love. Then you're like, and then it's all kind of fun and it's kind of funny, but it's like, you're not, there's no hooks in it necessarily. You're not invested in a personal way. But man, do they just nail the ever loving shit out of that. It's just like, it's really, yeah, really lovely. And just, it's, I loved it. I got totally teared up at the end when it says for Cherry. I just
yeah,
you know, but God almighty, it is wonderful. We just adored it. It was lovely, just in every way. But so yeah, so suffice it to say that yeah, Michael Sheen's pretty darn good.
Yeah. Although the heart and soul of Slaughterhouse Rules is definitely Asa Butterfield.
Yeah, our buddy Asa.
Holding it down hella flat in that, like, and it, this is an archetype that I kind of love, is the weird, aloof, like, seems preternaturally mature kid who is just hiding so much hurt. And that coolness is all masking just how wounded he is. And man, does he sell that.
Well, it's like a cross between,
he's so good.
It's a cross between Val Kilmer's character in Real Genius and Ferris Bueller, where, like, you know, yeah, he's clever, you know, he's sharp, you know, he's on top of everything, but he's also like, he's also got, yeah, some hurt, you know, for sure. And it's like, and that's a hell of a thing to pull off, especially for a young actor, you know, like he does it really well. And he centers the thing, you know, awfully well. I think this goes off the rails if everybody is just, if you couldn't pick one from the other one out, then I think it starts to become kind of tedious,
yeah,
for the first chunk of it. But instead you just get this kind of like, you're really sort of enjoyable thing. And it's also strange, well, not strange, like strange in a good way, I guess, to watch Peg and Frost play very different kinds of characters, you know, like,
yeah,
Frost has played a few fastidious types, you know, over the years, but it's just fun to watch him in this, like, not central role. And then Frost, mm-hmm, and then Nick Frost just being like, this is, oh my God, this is absurd, ridiculous, eco-terrorist
crazy
guy.
Like, cult leader almost. It's like, so you kids want to buy some drugs? Oh my God. Well, yeah, and Peg, you know, compared to Hot Fuzz or Shaun of the Dead or any of those, like, he is so utterly ineffectual through the whole thing, and like really sensitive and vulnerable and just not equipped for any of the madness that's happening around him. So that's fun. Our lead guy is a little stiff. That's who he's gotta be. He's just not as interesting as Asa Butterfield's character. But, you know, he's in there. He is kind of the basic dude, manages to not be super shitty. So I'll give that a good. Our Draco Malfoy guy is fascinating.
Oh my God, that guy.
He's just like 100% evil, but then there's kind of the implication that maybe he's like a self-loathing homophobe. Towards the end, did you get that?
I got that a little bit. Just very, 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 very uncomfortable in his own skin. Just like, just completely.
Oh, there's the lightest touch to it, yeah.
Yeah, just very, feeling it's like it's uneasy, and I'm just going to be very mad about being that, you know, and just being like, ah. Just.
And at the same time, he's super pretty. Like, he looks like he has a little bit of foundation on.
Yeah.
But then he is, he ratted out the other kid who then killed himself, and you kind of wonder, like, did they have anything going on? And, you know, all this in the periphery. So I had a wonderfully weird experience with this movie because I watched the beginning of it and fell asleep about 20, 25 minutes in. I think right when there's first something showing up on the radar. And I was like, that's so weird that we get this far into the movie and it is just the boarding school and going, like, meeting all the people and all the routines and them getting sorted into houses, which apparently they do. That is not just Harry Potter world. Or, like, Britain is Harry Potter world just all the time. But then, so I was watching this really sharp kind of boarding school drama, this, you know, like, or, you know, comedy drama, you know, like an 80s frat house flick, but with the, you know, kids in the boarding school. And then the monsters, and then the gore, and then the orgy and the silliness. It just got super weird on second night viewing. You know, it'd be kind of like if you watched Psycho right up until the shower started and then stopped. It was like, man, this has been a really taut crime thriller. I can't wait to see how this crime thriller resolves itself.
It's like, oh,
well, no.
Or if you try to have, have a conversation with somebody who only watched up to the shower scene, and then somebody who only watched from the shower scene.
Yeah, it's the blind people touching an elephant, you know.
It's just it's like, well, and you know, the thing about it is, like, and I don't want to belabor this too much, because, like, it feels like almost like a theme this week in a way, but, like, this was one of those ones where, you know, like, some people, because this premiered at Fantastic Fest last year, and, like, some people were like, oh, this is fun, this is a hoot, this is charming, this is cool, I'm enjoying this. And some people were just sort of like, oh, it's just very flat, it's very droll, it's overstuffed, all the the environmental stuff is just geo-gemmed in there, doesn't have any reason to be in there, all this kind of jazz, whatever. I'm just like, and so I was hearing some of this mixed sort of stuff, and it's like, so, I kind of think, like, okay, if the whole point of it is to take a crack at this kind of elitist sort of environment in this beautiful place. Unbelievable. God, I could just look at those grounds for a while. Like, good Lord, like, it's just, that place is just not to be believed. But it's one of those things where it's like, it's a B movie monster movie kind of romp. Like, it's just kind of like, you know, it's just, that's what it is. It's like, it's fun and it's kind of up on its heels. You know, it's got a little bit of heart to it for sure. And, like, I don't know, that's what it is. Like, that's what you're going to get from a movie like this. Like, it's just, it doesn't take itself too seriously, but it's not like having an in-joke on your expense either, you know? And that's all really positive. You know, that's just something that's kind of, yeah, I think they were trying to be sincere about their people and about their characters. And, like, you know, it's not Shaun of the Dead, but, like, nothing can be. You know, it's like, it's not gonna.
I think that might be the critique is that, so this is Simon Pegg and Nick Frost in this thing, and so is Michael Sheen, and yet it's not Hot Fuzz or Shaun of the Dead or World's End. It's like, but they didn't write it. You know, Edgar Wright didn't direct it. This is them kind of producing a work from a new voice and helping them find an audience with their celebrity. And I think that's noble, too. And it's also like, man, fuck, if we can only have movies that are as good as the very best that, like, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost have done, then we don't get to have very many movies.
Yeah, because it's like, at some point, it's like, you can't, all the stars can't align every single time, but that doesn't necessarily mean, like, I mean, take Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, for example. Like, does every single beat hit perfectly? Like, no. They're really off tone on some stuff that's in there. Overall, though, I really like it. I thought it's really good. And I think it really kind of, they really get after something kind of cool, and they are trying to put some sincerity in there, whatever else. But it's like, it's not, again, it's not Shaun of the Dead, but it's like, okay, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, like, there's something kind of cool about just sort of getting out and making a thing. And the Apocalypse is like, as much as I very, very dearly love it, like, you know, I said, like, is every single frame is not perfect. I mean, it's wonderful. But it's like, I mean, there's a lot of effort there. You know, this one's not as, like, up to that level or, like, Attack the Block or something. But, I mean, it's just, you know, I think if you walk into this knowing that you're going to just have kind of a fun second gear level romp that just gets a little nuts and gets a little crazy and is a little weird and, like, just with all the creature stuff and all the rest of it, like, just let it be that. Like, because that's what it is, and that's fun. Yeah, that's super fun. Plus, this is a fantastic fucking soundtrack. God damn. Like,
they
produced the living shit out of that soundtrack. It was awesome. That was phenomenal. Well done with the music. Like, up one side, down the other. Mm-hmm. It was really cool. Like, I really dug that. And I was like, man, they put some effort into there. Also, they put beautiful blonde girl, like, love interest, and then they have him, like, he's thinking, like, oh, well, she's into the guy who's the captain of the something, I don't know, whatever bullshit sport they're playing there, right? You know, cricket or lacrosse or some nonsense. And it's sort of like, it's like, no, is this her brother? Like, oh, okay. Yeah. But then what they do with that female character is they don't go, oh, there's a man who is interested in me. ha-fa-la-la-la. She just sort of, she's still just sort of herself. You know, like, they have a nice chemistry.
She doesn't.
But it's like, she doesn't, you know, doesn't go fa-la-la-la.
She doesn't power up and become just the ass-kicking person either. Which is kind of cool. Because the two ways that you can go are, like, Shrieking Violet the whole time through. Or, like, power up and becomes ultimate badass. And she just kind of stays on an even keel, like the first creature she's super freaked out by. But she is finally capable of just being as competent as the rest of them.
Yeah, yeah.
But not, like, taking the lead and, like, shoving her purse down a monster's throat or some shit. Like, she's just a people. And that's kind of cool. And, like, our jock guy is, you know, all of them are just barely competent at fighting a monster, which is what they should be, because they've never fought a monster before, you
amazing
know.
Amazing concept, that.
And so you get these kind of lovely, not really outsized characters. Even the little comic relief D&D playing guy and the little kid are just kind of funny. Like, in those earlier scenes, the kid, that poor little kid, is like, walks by covered in feathers. Did you pass the test yet? The fuck do you think?
Yes. That little that shot of him tied to the radiator or whatever, he's got the tie around his mouth, and like, hello, hello. It's just like, yeah. Oh, that tickled me. That was like Lucy Davis level timing, like, British timing. You know, it's just like, oh.
Well, he has that very, like, Flintstones, it's a living kind of thing. He's not like, crying or anything. He's like, yeah, well, here we are. This is, like, this reminded me of, well, it reminded me of Wet Hot American Summer and then the movies that inspired Wet Hot American Summer. So, like, the kids, well, like, you know, there's the kid, like, genre of, like, kids behaving badly, but then there's so few kids' horror movies, especially now, that are aimed at, like, a PG-13 that isn't ready for, like, Ouija Origin of Evil PG-13.
Yeah.
But, like, something that is kind of a romp and is fun, but is also really splat-sticky and weird, too. There's just not enough of those around, and I think people are trying to make this, like, judge this on a metric that is, like, a regular mainstream horror movie instead of this, like, it's a B-movie for young teenagers. And by that metric, it's fucking great. It's super fun, and there need to be more of these movies around, because there aren't any now. You know, and I think you're right, you mentioned Attack the Block. I think it's a really close analogy. I think Attack the Block is definitely a little more tighter put together, and has a little more on its mind than this does.
It's a little scarier, too.
Yeah. But at the same time, like, that is kind of the same deal. It's like that Gremlins mode of things, except you have giant, like, naked mole rat monsters. But, like, the peril is real. People are getting dismembered and, you know, fucked up 10 ways to Tuesday. So, I don't know, like, I'm with you. Like, people who say it's not as funny as it should have been. Like, how funny should it have been? What kind of funny should it have been? Please tell the people who made this movie what movie they should have made. And then fuck off, you know? If somebody didn't like it, that's fine. But I think you gotta take it on the merits and see if it's doing what it's trying to do. And I think it is.
Well, that's the thing. Like, in those parallels, what you're talking about, the kind of romp stuff, like, what in terms of the being a little bit more into the emotion of it, you know, like, you know, the whole thing with Simon Pegg and Margot Robbie's character, where she's, like, working somewhere with, like, you know, diseased children or something. Like, it's just, like, the most, like, magnanimous thing you could possibly be doing, you know, whatever. And she's got, like super handsome doctor guy in the background and all this kind of jazz. And it's like, well, it's not really going to work, you know, it's not really working out or whatever else. And, you know, this kind of thing. And he's just kind of, like, clinging on to it. It's sort of like, kind of like what you do with a high school romance or from summer camp or boarding school or
for sure.
Whatever. And it's like, that is the thing that he as an adult is, like, also kind of suffering through this kind of lousy thing that most of us have to go through at some point or other. And it's like, but he's doing it as an adult. But they don't make him the butt of the joke either. It's not like, oh, haha, isn't he pathetic? It's more just sort of like, he's really struggling with this, but he's really, at his heart, a decent dude. That doesn't necessarily mean that Margot Robbie's character is like a bad person either. It's just sort of more, it's more just a matter of being like, see these parallels? See how, like, being an adult kind of sucks, but also being a teenager kind of sucks, too, and, like, this is pretty good. And I will take that 100 times a day, even if it's not perfectly done, over, like, you know, cursing granny, or, like, you know, like, oh, white guy uses hip-hop slang lingo, or, like, just, like, that, those kind of jokes are just, like, so low-hanging fruit that they're not potatoes. And it's, like, but this kind of stuff, it's, sort of like, there's a humor to it, but there's a heart humor, in a way, and it's, like, I really appreciate that part of it. And it's just, and also people don't have like some big great revelation either. That's another thing. Like they all kind of relying on each other. They're trying to put together a plan. They're trying to get themselves out of this mess and this whole kind of thing. But there isn't some big poignant, you know, monologue. It's just kind of like, it's kind of like a, yeah, is it, are we okay? We're good. Yeah, man, we're all right. Okay. We gotta, let's go. Yeah, that kind of stuff. And it's like, man, good. Thank you for not doing
that. Yeah, they get it on the run, you know? Like, Butterfield's character gets his closure, and Don gets to show what a stand-up guy he is. But they get it on the run. It's just those tiny moments instead of stopping and having conversations, which is kind of great.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I really enjoyed this. I think this is a fun one. Yeah. This is certainly one that I would recommend in terms of, like, you know, if you are in possession of a teenager and, you know, they have an interest in, like, you know, monster movies or scary stuff, but they, you know, maybe they're going to be hanging out with friends and you don't want to have stuff with, like, explicit sex scenes or, like, just, like, torture, sort of heavy, really heavy, bloody stuff. Like, this is just perfect. This is absolutely perfect, you know, and it's like...
You had me thinking, though, when you said explicit sex scenes about implicit sex scenes. Where they just kind of sit down and then one of them is bobbing gently and somebody just like looks at the camera and then kind of glances down and then nods. Oh, it's happening.
It's like, it's just like you're going back and forth on which pitch to throw. I'm like, wait, what's happening here? Right. Why is this R again? I don't understand.
Why is there a sex scene where she's just grabbing her earlobes and then pinching her nose and then he throws a slider? It's weird. Yeah, so in my... by the way, I've got an account, folks, on letterboxd.com, which I'm reviewing all of the movies that I'm watching this year, because I've always wanted to have, at the end of the year, a list of them all. So we'll have it. I'm keeping it up. So on Letterboxd, I'm Nightwatch, NITEWATCH. And in my review for this, I said... This plays like the audience is 13-year-olds who are drawn in by the box art on the VHS tape at Blockbuster.
There you go.
Which is not to say it feels it's retro and like stroking a nostalgia bone in any way, but it has that spirit.
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
Like being a very modern movie, but it still has that spirit of like, hey, we can have some fun with this, and that's great. By the way, also creature design on this, I love the way they run, and they're just slightly off balance and everything. They're neat. I like these weird naked mole rat things. Yeah, so for me, this is like, I would say 7.5 out of 10. This is Sparta.
With the Z. Yeah, I think I'm right in the same marker. I really enjoyed this. I thought it was charming. Just a lot of production involved in putting something like this together and having it jive, you know, and just was very, very much bigger than I would have expected. You know, if you're kind of by the bootstraps, kind of trying to get somebody going on a new voice type of a situation, you know, it's like, this is a lot of scale for those kind of credentials coming in. So, you know, good on them for that too. Yeah, I enjoyed this. I thought it was fun. So, yeah, I'll also say 7.5 out of 10. 7.5 out of 10. The most comically ridiculous looking magic mushroom you could ever be taking a bite out of.
I love those things. Yeah, I expected him to grow to twice his size. Yeah.
it's like, who are you? But yeah, no, good stuff.
Do you want to break or you want to break or roll?
Let's break real fast. We'll use the restroom and then be back at you.
All right, this breaking news. We're taking a break.
Yes.
So next up we have Dr. Phibe Rises Again, or El Dr. Phibe Se Levantó Otra Vez. I'm disappointed because I thought it was Dr. Phibe's Rides Again, which I think is a better title. It's like,
I thought so
yeah,
too.
Like Destry Rides Again, you know, kind of a throwback, but no. I mean, it's more accurate. He doesn't really ride anything, but he does rise at the beginning of this. Yeah. So at the end of the last Dr. Flurbs, if you remember, he went to lie in a, like, fancy hippie coffin beside his wife. And in this one, we find that because of the certain phase of a moon, it aligns in just the right way, and it illuminates a thing and flips a switch, and he's back. I mean, what else do you want? He's back. Oh, the best thing, though, is way more movies should do this. The way they deal with catching you up from the first movie is not through artful flashback or a character delivering exposition. Oh, no. It is like the narrator, the narration from the Super Friends. Mm-hmm. They're like, he was born and the abominable Dr. Phibes, and he did a thing and his face was all fucked up and look at his face. And then he killed a bunch of people and then, oh, he laid down next to his wife, but he'll probably rise again. And it goes on for like a minute and a half. Jess was sitting there watching it. She's like, what the fuck is going on? And I said, oh, I will have you know, this is not the trailer for the second movie. This is the second. This voiceover is contained within the movie. And that just blew her mind.
You walk into the theater. You sit down. This is what they're showing you.
And it's like footage from the last movie and just a guy explaining it in very like 60s movie trailer fashion. So like it's ruthlessly efficient. It gets you in there.
I thought it was fabulous. It's super so charming. It's just like, it made me think of that. It's just like, because it kept going. I thought it was longer than that. I thought it was a few minutes, but it was like, that's what it made me think of Silent Night, Deadly Night 2. Like you watched the first movie? Yeah, we're going to do that for a little bit. Like just, I mean, literally it'll be footage from it. And, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be, this will work out fabulously. I would tend to say that Dr. Phibes Rises Again, I think is a uniformly better movie than Silent Night, Deadly Night 2.
For sure. I think it may be a better movie than The Abominable Dr. Phibes if we're going to get right down to brass tacks. I know it's a bold statement, but I feel like the first one had these great scenes, but it was really weighed down by the pacing. And this one is just like, fuck it. We're not even going to try and pretend that we're doing like The Plagues of Egypt or here's the detectives have to solve the case. Like, most of this is just going to be Dr. Phibes doing weird shit and Dr. Phibes killing people. And, like, that's totally fine by me. And it kind of realizes his potential. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, no, I think so. I think it's sort of like they get the... I think they get the dynamic down to where you're just sort of like, what this has to be is this Technicolor nonsense. And you just kind of go, like, you know, in the first movie, it's much more of like, you know, for not using the right term, but it's kind of like a... kind of like a slasher in a lot of respects, where it's sort of like, well, he's just going to have to... He's killing a bunch of people in a variety of fantastic ways. And it's sort of like, but, you know, that tends to wear a little thin, tends to a little bit along the tooth, wherever. Whereas this one is just sort of like, we're going to bring in all this Egyptian stuff, and we're going to bring in all those other kinds of things, and we're going to have these very quippy, kind of funny, to really funny, lines in some of the stuff where it's like, it amazes me... some of the little stuff back and forth with the archaeologist and those guys that just some of the quippy dialogue back and forth is just, it's kind of amazing, really. Some of that stuff, like, was it the one guy said that, was it the one line, said the thing about the Gloucester squirt murder? And it was just sort of like, it was just like, oh, golly. So I don't know, this had like some really bizarro life to it in a very, very, very strange way. That I admired and like never got necessarily bored with. I just sort of was like, well, this is whatever weird shit they're gonna do now. Like, all right, well, let's do that one. Like, for example, when Phibes is spying on them and does the like little like kind of like head on the shelf sort of gag from Young Frankenstein,
right.
But like, you know, he's just like a head up, a head on the on a pile of bones, whatever. I was like watching them, and then you get this wonderful shot of him like coming back into the little lair with Volnavia, and he comes in there, and the first thing he goes like kind of like, you know, getting all the dust off of him, and like, oh god,
no, for sure.
It's like just so charming and stupid.
He's fun. He's fun throughout, and it is kind of amazing. Could we talk last time about how the weirdness of casting Vincent Price in your movie and rendering him unable to speak? So he can only emote with his face, which he does with gravitas befitting Vincent Price, and then kind of his this tinny, kind of pre-recorded sounding voice comes out, and it's like a little bit Vincent Price, and then a little bit not, and that's super fun. By the way, we watched The Great Mouse Detective with the kids last weekend. I realized I hadn't seen that for probably 20, maybe 25 years. And Vincent Price in there. It's kind of amazing. So, anyway, that happened. But, so, this is a movie that will just give you stuff like, Fibes has a clockwork band that he takes with him everywhere. And when he sails to Egypt to revive his wife, he puts his wife in like a sideshow caravan with some big sparkly lights and the whole clockwork band in the trailer, and then loads them all on the cruise ship for somebody to find when they like come down below decks. And that's great. And the guy who finds it ends up getting shoved inside a giant gin bottle, like a ship in a bottle, where it's not really clear how they got him in there. And that's great. You just kind of keep going through this. And it is kind of fascinating all the way out. Like, none of this is any good, but it's like a psychedelic 60s version of Saw, the way that it's put together.
Well, and I love all the little touches. I mean, the band is one thing, but I also love the ridiculous piano. It's like, what?
Oh, yeah.
From whose collection did that come
from? The fact that he had a whole backup lair in Egypt that had all of his shit in it, just so that they could just use the same set. That's lovely.
Oh, of course. Yeah, it's like, that doesn't follow any kind of logical pattern, but it's just cool.
So he's got, I was thinking of the kills in this. There's the dude that gets sandblasted to death. The guy with the, like, the screw press in the bed. There's the scorpion thing that grabs the guy by the wrists. And then just, like, that scorpions very crawl all the hell over him, yeah.
Because so a couple of the scorpions look silly.
Yeah, well, they
look a little wobbly and silly.
But some of them are just live vinegaroons, and like, we know that the bigger a scorpion is, the less dangerous it is. So that's kind of, it's fun to see the giant things and know that they could pinch him, but they're not going to hurt him, you know?
Yeah, but it's still, they're just like, just bleh. It's icky. And then you get the bird. Get the bird attack.
Oh, yes, yes. Mustn't forget the dude who just gets owned by an eagle or whatever, or hawk. And then we have the best part about that though,
Joshua, is the bird comes back to the lair, and then the bird says, "Well, did you have an enjoyable dinner? Did you enjoy this thing or else?" And he's kind of looking out, and just being as a bird, is not going to be trained by anyone to do anything. The bird is sort of like he should be looking over at Vincent Price, but he kind of looks off the distance, turns around, looks like directly in the camera, then looks off again. And this is sort of like. It's like that bird was breaking the fourth wall in 1972.
You gotta have the like little double takes from the bird.
What?
Okay. That's a living. Yeah. They also have the presaging the Last Crusade with the guy aging rapidly at the end. So there's another immortal who's been keeping himself alive with a serum that he's run out of. And so he needs to find the same, like, water of life and rejuvenation that Fibes needs to find. So he's, like, tracking with Fibes the whole time and then is kind of angling to get resurrected. And when Fibes refuses, he kind of ages and falls apart right outside of the gate to where his eternal life would have been. And so that's kind of fun. I love the... Throughout, our sympathy pretty much lies exclusively with Fibes.
Yeah.
Because nobody else is really doing it for me. You know, it's like, I am just kind of rooting for him to accomplish his goal. Like, if everyone would just leave him the fuck alone, he would just go resurrect his wife and fuck off, you know? He's not trying to cover the land in blood, and he's just trying to get his wife back. I could see that. And so I love at the end that he just kind of does. Like, none of the crowd is able to stop him, and he just kind of goes, and he's, for all appearances, just sailing off to resurrect his lady.
Which, I mean, that's got to be an interesting conversation, don't you think?
How so?
Well, just sort of like, well, I've been dead, and
you've been dead for a bit.
What's the little pressure valve on your neck, and what are we up to? Because I mean, it's like, you know, she just sort of, her job is to lay there, mm-hmm. you know, for this movie, for in the last one, and then into this one, and it's just sort of like he has this grand adventures of all these different things and firing. You know, unicorns, cross the trebuchet, and all the rest of the things. And he's done all this stuff. And it's just sort of like, and then she's going to wake up and she's hi. You know, it's just kind of, it's so weird.
You have to explain why he doesn't have a face. That's going to be rough. Because remember, he doesn't really look like Vincent Price. He really looks like a mummy.
Oh yes, yeah. There's love's saying, never having to say you're ugly or something. Is that was it the line?
Right.
from the first one, that poster. Yeah.
He doesn't.
It's a trip. I just like.
He doesn't actually get that face out much in this movie either. There's the because again, it seems like they are really just turning him into the hero. And I, you know, like I said, I can totally handle that. It's fun.
Oh, yeah. No, it's fun to just watch. Like, this is kind of one of those things where, I don't know about you, but I just kind of get the thing where you just kind of watch through, like, okay, what else are you going to give me?
Mm-hmm.
What else? Okay, what's the next crazy thing? All right, we'll go with that for a little bit. Like, sure. You just kind of, this is one of the most ultimate roll with it type things.
Yeah.
You just kind of go, well, you just kind of accepted it on its own terms. It's kind of like, in a lot of ways, it reminds me a little bit of, like, The Devil Rides Out, where you're like, well, you strap in. Because they were just going to give you so much nonsense.
Oh, I love The Devil Rides Out, though. Isn't that the one McConaughey Goat?
Yes.
McConaughey Goat.
Yeah, and my lucky star is a Negro. Right.
And the giant spider. Like, yeah, Devil Rides Out is choice.
But it's like, it's in that same ballpark where you're just like, not the same thing, certainly, but it's in that same ballpark where you're like, everybody had great ideas and they just decided to do all of them. You're just going to throw it all in there at one, just see what all, we're just going to do all of it.
Yeah.
Like, cool. And there's a spirit to that, and this is fun.
I respect it. This is one of the few, like, trippy cult movies that has enough zip in it to really live up to its reputation, I feel like. Because there are plenty that are like, oh my god, you got to see this, man. You got to see Altered States. And you watch Altered States and you're like, oh my god, but oh man, could they cut half hour out of this movie? And this one
is all the boring.
Yeah. And this one, you know, it's weird and it's clunky in parts, but it just keeps rolling. And it doesn't, it's not portentous and draggy in a way that movies like this can be. It's just kind of silly and fun. So, I did like this better than the first one, even though the first has the awesome unicorn kill and the having to unscrew the guy off the horn bit, which is pretty great.
Well, and also the Brussels sprout thing.
Yeah. I mean, oh god, yeah. this is like the Lego Movie 2. Of the Fibes saga, because it's got us
the first time that has ever been said.
Yeah, man, it's got a smaller scope, and it has a different vibe, but it's just as good in its own, like, slightly less ambitious way. You know, like, it still bugs me that Lego Movie 2 didn't do the box office that it should have, because it is, to me, every bit as heartfelt and funny and cool as the first one. And so this one, I feel like it's the same thing. It's kind of doing its own thing. It's a little bit smaller in scope and a little bit less weird, but it's still plenty fucking weird. So, I don't know. I will give it an amused 6 out of 10. In the middle of the night. Dunkelbook and Imhotep. Because, you know, River of Life, I guess. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I might go. I might go just a hair, lower. I mean, I still enjoyed it. I think it's good fun and is entertaining, certainly. You know, but it's sort of like there's only so much droll British talking back and forth thing that you can, you know. I get a great amount of joy out of that, before, of course. But at a certain point, like, you get these guys all standing around for 7 or 8 minutes to sort of like. It's like, well, I told him I did. Did you? I did. I'm like, oh, good Lord. Like, let's move on with it already. And so, like, you know, I mean, overall, I think it's cool. And I do enjoy it. I don't think it's, you know, boring by any stretch. But, you know, it's sort of like, I certainly have a soft spot for the first one and all that's madness, even though this one is very enjoyable as well. So, I'm just going to go back to the Gloucester Squirt Murder. So, 6 out of 10 Gloucester Squirt Murders.
Oh, for the record, I rated the first one a 5, and I think I would stand by that. And you rated the first one 4.5, so.
Did I?
Yeah.
Huh.
Must have been, maybe you're having a shitty day, who knows?
Yeah, that's weird.
But yeah, I'm with you. I think I said 6.5, but I think I'm going to adjust to 6 just to stay, you know, stay frosty. I don't want to compromise the rest of my illustrious career. By rating it too highly, you know. I don't want to fly too close to the sun.
It's true. You said that found out what happened to the Dick at Icarus.
Right. Dick at Icarus. My God.
Yeah, exactly. You say that 5 times.
Bless you. And bless the child. Our final movie of the week is Bless the Child. Or Bendiciones al Niño. Or Niña, because it's a lady. Boy, have I never seen a movie that's like an exorcist-type movie, except the kid is good.
Yeah, the kid is great in this.
No, I don't mean like, a good actor. I mean a force of good.
Oh, okay.
Because it's like...
I thought she did a good job, too.
Yeah, she does a good job, but this is the opposite of an exorcist movie, where we have the kid of kind of iffy parentage, and she's very quiet and keeps to herself, and she seems to have some kind of power. And she is just a force of good in the world. And that's cool.
To a very sweet degree as well. Like there's, right. You know, like there's a very sweet tone about her. You know, that, just very lovely and just kind of like, it's, there's something kind of positive about it, which is kind of nice. I always kind of appreciated that in a lot of ways. So it's kind of a lovely thing. So the thing I wanted to get off my chest real fast about,
for sure.
About Kim Basinger is that, like, so this movie came out. Was it in 2000, if I'm not mistaken? And so this was like right in the stretch of time where Kim Basinger had done like a few different movies. That weren't really well received, this being one of them. And then there was like I Dream of Africa is another one. And there's about a couple other things that she had done. But then there was also this very, very public, very tabloid saturated situation with her and Alec Baldwin and all this mess with their daughter and all the rest of this back and forth and stuff. And anybody who claims to have any kind of insight into somebody's personal life just because they're a public figure can just go fuck themselves with a broomstick. And so like, but all that stuff was going on. It was all the tabloid stuff, all this kind of jazz. And there was this tonal shift in the United States in 2000 around that ballpark that was like, you know what? Fuck Kim Basinger. She's an asshole. She's an idiot. She's a jerk. She's does all this kind of stuff. And we don't like her. We don't think she's any good. And it's sort of like there was a sort of negative cloud around her for a while. And it's sort of like, I don't understand. I don't get it. But there was a vibe for a bit of time. It was like, oh, it's Kim Basinger's in that. Like, oh, God. You know, like, and Renée Zellweger got that a little bit a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like, I don't get it. I think, I don't know, I don't want to play armchair psychologist for this fucked up country, but it's sort of like, there seems to be this thing where it's sort of like, oh, well, you're doing well and you've got all these things going for you. Like, oh, you get knocked down a couple of pegs. Like, ah, serves you right. Stupid woman trying to do stuff. Like,
yeah.
Like, in this weird subconscious way. And I think Kim Basinger was very much a victim of that. And it's just sort of like... And so, in a weird way, watching this, I was like... I was kind of rooting for it, in a way. Because I was like, yeah, fuck those people.
Yeah.
Like, which is stupid. It was just an absolutely stupid thing, you know? But it's just sort of like... I just, in a way, I kind of like... there was an I kind of had an embracing of it in some weird way just because of the, all that kind of bullshit tabloid nonsense that was going on with her. And it's just sort of like thinking how unjust all that kind of crap is, you know. And it's just sort of like, and for its merits, like, this movie's all over the map, you know, like, it's all over the map, this movie.
Yeah, it is.
But at its core, it's not uninteresting. You know, it's like, it's kind of, it's a fascinating, weird thing.
It's interesting, too, because it is those forces of good and evil type movies where the force of good actually shows up. So it's not like Devil's Advocate or even The Exorcist, where the devil is real and he's on Earth, but God is very distant and almost theoretical, and it's kind of leaving it for the humans to sort it out. In this, like, she's constantly getting helped along the way by these people who will just give a little nudge in the right direction and then just kind of, like, tip their hat a little bit, you know, or give a little bit of shine to see that they're angels. And I thought that was super neat because you walk a weird line when you're doing a movie like this. And if you push it too far, you end up in, like Christian movie land. And that's...
Oh, yeah, that's sure.
No good. Like, you don't want to have it just be completely... trying to sell you Jesus. But on the other hand, it is nice to see, like, God actually get in a couple of innings in this.
Well, and I think you kind of hit the nail upon the top about the tone for that stuff goes, because I certainly have a very highly tuned BS detector when it comes to that kind of stuff. I know you do. And it's sort of like, and so if it starts to come across as too sanctimonious, you're like, oh, no. That's not necessarily good.
Yeah, I don't want her to, like, I don't want Kim Basinger to grab the daughter and kneel down and pray that they'll let Jesus into her heart, and then, like, God shows up with a flaming sword and some shit, you know, but I love that idea that, like, in as much as there are forces of evil out there, that there is a force for good, too. And I love all those little moments where the girl gets to demonstrate that. Like, the tests that Rufus Sewell tries to put her through, and she just kind of continues to kill with kindness, like hugging the homeless guy.
I know, and it's just sort of like, but that's the thing, like, I think they do walk that fine line very well in just trying to, like, establish, you know, those parameters. I mean, there are certainly faults, you know, with this. Like, if you're a jerk, you can fault them for the CGI, you know, like,
I mean, I'll be that jerk, it's pretty bad.
It is, no, but I mean, like, but so here, but here's the thing, like, you know, on the one side, you know, somebody like Matt would say, like, well, when did Jurassic Park come out? And that's completely valid. You know, this didn't have, like, it had, like, nothing, didn't have, like, no budget. And so, like, I think that's a valid complaint. But at the same time, like, I mean, yeah, you can just kind of accept it for what they're wanting to do with it and be like, okay, well, it does look shitty. It doesn't look good. But at the same time, you just kind of go, well, they're wanting to depict all the demons floating around. And, like, in that scene where they're beating up Christina Ricci in the subway, like, I mean, the demons don't look good, but what they're going for is pretty awesome. Like, that's a great concept.
And I guess discovery of the body, too, yeah. It reminded me of...
stuff, and that's neat.
Demons reminded me a little bit of Hideaway.
Oh, huh.
With, you know, the Jeff Goldblum, Alicia Silverstone.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
they
yeah,
had
yeah,
the, sure. just, like... very literal, very straight up CG demons, and it like, it looks silly in a way that it doesn't have to, though. I mean, even given a budget, like a low budget, and the time that it was made and everything, it could have looked better than that, but it didn't. Yeah, you know, I mean, and that's where,
like,
we're at,
and it makes me wonder. No, I mean, it's like, I just mean that, like, if you were to, if someone was to watch this and go, because the demons look stupid, therefore it is a shitty movie, like, that's kind of dumb, because it's like, that's more what I mean. It's kind of like, it's just sort of like, well, you just kind of accept them for what they are. What you can hang your hat on, though, is, like, there's a lot more artistry in the way they put this together and some of the shots and stuff. Like, good Lord. Like, they really just swing the camera every which way and stick it in places. And there's one shot in the apartment where I swear to God, they must have stuck the camera up on the ceiling.
Yeah.
And, like, stuck a dude up there to operate it and, like, did this little tracking thing down the hallway with her and the walking and the whole bit. And it's like, it didn't need to be in this silly movie, but it's like, it was there. And it's like, that kind of adds to the vibe, you know, like, there's something kind of good about that. I dig that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then, like, the whole, and then the dynamic with Jimmy Smits and the rest of the cops, like, it's like it starts to come like kind of like a whole, you know, like, you know, cops razzing the sky or whatever else. But then at some point, like, they were going to try to do it police procedural in a way, but then they're like, yeah, we ain't got time for that. We gotta get to some other stuff. And then they just kind of want to go, you know. It's like I kind of admire them for like we stumble onto a police procedural movie, but we got places to go.
Yeah,
and so we can't stay around here for too long.
It didn't try to be The Prophecy and spend a little too much time with the cop story, because, you know, that's the B story.
The one real clunker that really did get under my skin, it really kind of annoyed me actually, was like when Samantha Mathis's character comes back with Rufus Sewell and she's like, you know, like, I'm better now, and that whole bit. Like, now we understand that he's drugging her still and all that kind of bad stuff and sort of using her to get to the daughter and stuff. But every piece of dialogue they give Samantha Mathis to say once she shows back up is just the fucking worst. Like, it's like, all of it is really bad.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, ay. Like, it's just, I get what they're doing with the character, and I get where it is in the story and stuff. I mean, I understand all that for sure. But it's just like, man, there's just no sympathy. You're just like, I don't know about you, but I was like, you know, I don't know. You could just die, I guess. Yeah. Like, I don't care. Like, she's just really awful, and like, it's a very off-putting kind of way. It's like, man. No, no me gusta that.
This is a hell of a cast, though. We have to point that out. So you got Kim Basinger.
Oh, yeah.
And Jimmy Smits are our two leads. Rufus Sewell is the villain. Pre-May Angela Bettis is the sister.
Yeah.
And then, like, in between Casper and Black Snake Moan, Christina Ricci, which I know that is a broad span of movie. That is not a broad span of years, though, in a weird way. So it's like, and fucking Ian Holm shows up for a scene.
The lovely Ian Holm.
Yeah, just to be in there for a bit and make me go, how the fuck old is Ian Holm? Because he is old in this, and this was 20 years ago now. That's kind of amazing. Like, all right. So, you got a lot of cool cast in here. Some of the stuff with the gang of demons and everything is pretty neat, what the human, like, gang gets up to. I kind of dug the way that the ending played out, too. It's hard to say, like, I think at the heart of it, this is not a very good movie. And it's hard to really pinpoint why. It is just a little bit too silly and a little bit too disjointed and doesn't quite land any of the planes that are circling. But at the same time, it's got really fun parts. Yeah, so it's hard to quantify.
There's a lot of components. Yeah, there's a lot of components that jive for sure, and it's just sort of like, yeah, no, I think that it's the nail upon the top pretty well, where it's sort of like there are components that really do work and are very interesting, and it's like, but then you have like all this interconnected stuff where he's like, this is very flat. I'm like, come on, let's pick up back the pace. I did love, as I always do, in any movie that's older, the way, like, they use technology of any kind. I've really started to become almost like a fetishist in a way with that kind of thing. Like, anytime technology shows up, anything that's, like, 2000 or earlier, I just, like, love it. It's just, like, you know, she's on the computer doing the thing, the little, like if a dot matrix printer was somehow stuffed into the computer, because it's, like, she's putting, you know, the paying the bills and whatever else, and it's, like, like, golly. I get a kick out of that. I think that's just something awesome. I really enjoy that. I just think it's great. There's just, you know, it's kind of lovely. I also really love that they don't, and maybe I'm wrong about this, and maybe this is something that I have like a blind spot or a lack of familiarity, but I like how they don't overplay her, you know, quote unquote disability, or they don't, you know, it's not like one of those things where that's a big point of the movie. You know, like, you know, like Burning Bright, you know, like that's a very key part of it, and certainly that, you don't take anything away from that. But here it's sort of like, you know, it's not like that is a stumbling block of the plot to have to get through, is that like she's like this high functioning and she has all this extra stuff. Like, it's a part of the story and it's part of her relationship with Kim Basinger's character and all this kind of stuff, but like they don't just hang a lot of it on that type of thing or yeah, that she's going to be making bad decisions or whatever because of her disability or any kind of nonsense. They don't really they don't really get too much into that kind of stuff, which I certainly appreciate.
Although at the same time, you can tell that it's from the, you know, the 2000s, so like very late 90s, because it came out in 2000, because they say like, well, you know, she has a disease known as autism. And several people are like, autism, what's that? Like, autism, whoa, that's, whoa, like, hardly anybody has that. Instead of like, oh yeah, she's on the spectrum, and everyone will go, oh, okay. It's just weird to think back to a time when that was, we're still really starting to understand what that meant. So it could have just been like, she has consumption, and I was like, what the hell you say? Yeah, it's not... It was just not as much in the lingo, and that was like the exotic thing they could think of to have. There were a couple of movies, now that I think about it, when, you know, like when Hollywood discovers stuff and it's in every movie for a little bit in a very embarrassing way.
Oh, yeah.
Like when Hollywood discovered trans people, and it was like Crying Game and Ace Ventura and like Silence of the Lambs, and then we kind of chilled out. So there was like this for autism, there was this, and then Mercury Rising was another one, right? I think there was even a third one that had an autistic kid who had magic powers. Oh, Jess's friend Asha was a child actor in a movie with, I think, Donald Sutherland. That was House of Cards. It was about a girl with autism who was also like telekinetic. So it was a thing for a little while. They're like, yeah, so autism is the thing that will make children interesting. And until people are like, you know, that is a real thing that happens to people, and it doesn't actually give them superpowers that we know of. Just a way of being.
The two of the more horrific kind of moments was the one of them was the when they lured the little boy into the van with the puppy.
Oh God!
I was like, God, that just wrenched my heart. I was like, oh, there's God damn it. Like, it was just like, that was just, and then you just kind of blammo, and you're like, ah, fuck me. Like, this is, that was a really wrenching kind of thing.
To be fair, though, that may be the first guy who actually did that who had a puppy.
Yeah.
You know, at least they didn't lie to the kid. Like
that poor puppy just feels very complicit in the whole thing, which is sort of like, it gave him a bit of a complex.
I feel like when you say, who's a good boy, he's like, I wish I was, man. I used to be.
I'm not. I have dirty paws. I have dirty paws. Yeah. The other thing was the kind of the nanny lady, like getting in the car with the guy who's the guy from In Home sort of deal, and then he's like helping her, and then he's like, and the guy who does not looking around enough. When you're waiting in a car, you got to look around a lot. And he just, you know, car door thunk. And then he's like, oh, good. I was wondering about the thing. And then nanny lady just sticks two knitting needles direct in his eyes.
Yeah.
Golly.
Not even a warning shot.
Yeah, just thud. Like, man, that's unpleasant. Mm. It's just like, so I mean, it had those moments for sure. And then Rufus Sewell, like, it's just, they just, he's got that smarmy thing that's just like, just unpleasant, just very unpleasant, and just like every other part of it. And if I was going to get into like rules not seeing for sure, like there are so many things about this whole like them showing back up and like taking the daughter or whatever else, and I just like there was part of me there just for a brief moment when they're like hassling her at her apartment when Samantha Mathis's character is clean and stuff. I was like, this part of my brain was just sort of like, wait.
Yeah.
There is a process, a procedure for the authority. She would have had to have got a social security card and there's the immunizations and then the guardianship, and then that would have been done through a court and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, brain, this movie does not care about those things.
Yeah. That's only going to slow you down.
Yeah, it's like, it's not worth the, it's not worth the brain juice. So I was like, I'll leave that where it sits. But I just, you know, like, this is not the best, certainly not the best movie by any stretch of imagination, but I don't think it's boring. And I don't know that this necessarily was one of those cynical late 90s, early 2000s kind of cash-in-y movies. Although there are times where it feels like this is, we're making a movie in the movie kind of things. But on the overall, like, yeah, I thought it was fun. It's just kind of a thriller romp type of deal. And, you know, I don't know. I kind of thought it was all right.
Yeah, for sure. So throw a number on there. What do you think?
So let's see. I'm going to say... Well, how do you rate something like this exactly, I wonder? Well, I guess I'm going to find out. I want to be real generous, I guess, and say 5.
Yeah.
I'll say 5 out of 10. I'll say 5 out of 10. 5 out of 10. I was going to make a joke about Rufus Sewell's eye, but I'm not going to. Out of 10.
Oh, you're a better man than I am, Gunga Din. Yeah, I think it's weird to, like, not dislike it or have, like, a major gripe about it, but at the same time feeling like it would be irresponsible to rate it any higher than 5 for sure. I think I would say it's about 4.5. Let's say 4.5 out of 10. Christina Ricci getting ahead in life.
God, that's unpleasant. That's another. I forgot about that part.
That is the scene in this movie that is like the nurse walking down the hallway in Exorcist 2, and the thing just appears behind her with the knife, with the scissors. That was this movie's moment of like, whoa, shit. And it's like, and now we return you to your regularly scheduled movie. But for a second there, it was really goddamn harrowing.
I did love Christina Ricci's thing where she's like, bring cash. So the thing, like, we know that this lady's like really trapped for you know, money in general and whatever else. And she's like, this is all you brought? Like, look, asshole. It's like, I understand you're in a bind, however.
Like, can I just...
Money does not grow on trees, Christina Ricci.
Can I just Venmo you? All right, well, let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back with some movies to watch next week. Goodbye.
Yes.
So for next week, we have a group of 90s movies that ended up being one of those things where we talked about the movies that we wanted to do, and we ended up with a list that's like only one third the thing that we talked about. So it'll be fine. We're going to watch...
It's fun if this works.
We're going to watch Cut, featuring Molly Ringwald. We're going to watch Fallen, the classic mainstream thriller thing that the 90s did for a little bit with horror. And that's got, of course, the Denzel Washington up in. And then we're going to watch Cast a Deadly Spell, which is horror adjacent and features Fred Ward and apparently is real fucking strange. So that'll be fun. And then our short is called Quitter from the Box Lightner brothers, who brought us the incredibly tense Downstairs. So that should be a lot of fun to watch. So Cut, Fallen, Cast a Deadly Spell, and Quitter. And with that, I will point out to you, as I must every week, that I've been Josh this whole time, and Matt has not been hearing for that. He is sorry, and I say bye.
This is... pardon me. This is Charlie down in Austin. This is Charlie down in Austin. Take care. Have a good week. Do keep in mind, ladies and jelly spoons, that there is in the myriad of big summer movies that of which I'm mostly excited for almost all of them. I can't wait to see Spider-Man. I can't wait to see Toy Story. You know, like, I'm looking forward to this stuff, of course. There are some horror things coming out in the theaters to keep your eyes on for sure. Child's Play is going to be up the 21st of this month. In August will be Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. This week is a thing that I have now forgotten what the fuck it is. Oh, The Dead Don't Die, Jim Jarmusch's one with Adam Driver and Bill Murray and everybody. Tom Waits is in there, Iggy Pop, and the whole crew. And then there's a few other ones sprinkled in there. Zombieland won't get till fall, but there's a few other things coming out this summer that I'm just spacing on. But do go on to comingsoon.net and look at the release dates on stuff, because there are some horror things making it into theaters, which I you know, especially in the summer movie season, like, you know, if you got a few bucks to throw, like, if you can get them into a few of those ones, it certainly helps folks make the case to put more money into things, you know, definitely. So I think it's worthwhile. Oh, Crawl's the other one. Crawl's going to come out, like, in July. It's alligators, and it's, like, a flood, and that'll be great. So anyway, just keep that in mind when you're heading out to the theater. And I certainly will be going to see Child's Play here in a couple weeks, of course, but take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and then we will talk towards you again real soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
And somebody said, like, well, no, of course they know that they're not going to remake it. It's just they're saying that they're that mad at it. And I was like, yeah, but they can get fucked. Like, nobody owes them shit. You watch the whole show, and they owe you your ending that you wrote in your fan theory. Like, eat shit and die. They wanted the last three episodes to just be the Hodor taking a dump. That would be fine. They can do that. You know? So weird. Oh, well.